From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Remarkable developments this afternoon in Washington. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted to advance Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court to the full Senate for a vote, while also agreeing to not have that vote for about a week while they allow the FBI to investigate sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh. Flake had earlier said that he would vote for Kavanaugh. Beth Fooey is senior politics editor for NBC. She joins us now. Beth, this is quite a stunner, another one in the last 24 hours. What do you think happened here?
Well, boy, Jeremy, you know, when I was on your show a couple of hours ago, I said that the Senate was essentially broken. But now we suddenly have kind of a ray of hope. Maybe it's not. This was a clear bipartisan move by Jeff Flake, who realized after he had announced that he would support this nominee coming out of the Senate Judiciary Committee vote. He met with so much objection from activists, from people surely calling into his office, and also his fellow senators, that he is said to have worked with Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat, who he's very close friends with, to come up with an arrangement that could work for everyone. He would agree to get this nomination out to the floor of the Senate, but in doing so, say it's basically conditioned on having an FBI look into some of these allegations that are against Brett Kavanaugh. He's also now, we are told, got a couple of other senators on board with him who were the other undecided votes. Senator Lisa Murkowski, for one. Apparently, Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, is also supportive of this measure. So that basically hands Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell an offer he can't refuse. He doesn't have the votes if he doesn't go along with this. I mean, we all know he's a very crafty legislative magician, and perhaps he has some way that he can think of to come up with a way to get this thing through without going along with this arrangement. But I don't see how that's the case. And furthermore, President Trump was just asked about this about an hour ago at the White House, and he seemed pretty sanguine about it. He was willing to do whatever was necessary to make this go along. So perhaps we have a little bit of ray of bipartisanship back in the U.S. Senate.
Well, and let's just remind people about the numbers here. McConnell needs 51 votes in order to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court in the full Senate. There are two Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine, who have not said which way they're going to vote on Brett Kavanaugh. And then Jeff Flake was the other one that people were unsure of. And then he came out and said today that he was going to vote to advance Kavanaugh. And then the other one that you mentioned there, Joe Manchin, he's a Democrat in a red state that Trump won by a lot, West Virginia. People thought maybe he would flip away from where the other Democrats are going and perhaps support Kavanaugh. Now he says, no, we've got to wait for this FBI investigation.
Right. He said he agreed with Flake's position.
So what happens now? when is the vote in the Senate going to be to decide that they will indeed wait a week on the vote on Kavanaugh?
You know, I don't think there needs to be a vote. Mitch McConnell is in charge of scheduling everything. And if he decides that this is the only way to go, he will set a vote for, or he will say, let's go ahead with this investigation. Keep in mind, though, Jeremy, that the Senate cannot on its own call for the FBI to do anything. The White House has to ask
right.
the
President
FBI
Trump
to do
has
it.
To do it.
But it seems from what we saw from President Trump about an hour ago at the White House that he wasn't going to stand in the way of the FBI doing this. So a whole lot of remarkable things unfolding here. We do know that the Republican senators, evidently the entire Republican Senate conference, is going to have a meeting sometime this afternoon to discuss all of this. And maybe we'll get a little bit more clarity after that.
Do you think it's possible that at the end of the day, Brett Kavanaugh does not make it onto the Supreme Court?
Look, who knows? This is not a any sort of story that where any predictions have come true basically for anyone. So I'm hesitant to make any prediction myself. Look, this seems to be a win-win all the way around. This is what the Democrats, to a person on that committee yesterday, insisted that they wanted, which was an FBI investigation into this matter. And now it looks like they're going to get that. So that, to me, says that they are pretty much going to have to accept the outcome of that investigation, whether it clears Brett Kavanaugh or not, because they are getting what they asked for. It's a very significant step.
What more can you tell us about how senators are thinking about this politically at this point? There's a midterm election coming up in just weeks.
Right. And right now, the map, as we've said for many months, is very favorable to Republicans. There are a lot of those Democrats in red states that Trump won who are up for re-election. But at this point, Jeremy, what we've seen in the most recent couple of weeks is a whole ton of polling showing the generic ballot, certainly for the House, is very much favoring Democrats at this point. It's double digits in our NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, but in several others, around 10, 12, 14 points, many, many reputable polls are showing. And that means that if it's so favorable for Democrats in the House, it's indicating that it could be a wave that actually affects the Senate, too. These things don't happen one without the other. If there's a big wave, it typically hits everything. It hits Senate, it hits governor's races, it hits the House, it hits state legislative. It all moves in one direction. So senators know that the control of the Senate is not a sure bet at all for Republicans at this point. So that's why there's been this rush to get Kavanaugh through. That's why Jeff Flake doing what he did and perhaps getting the Republicans to go along with this. Is significant because it does push off that vote and yep. We still don't know who's going to control the Senate come next year.
Beth Fooey of NBC.
Well, of course, the hearing set social media afire with the partisan divide in the hearing room reverberating through cyberspace. Let's get our weekly social media roundup with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. And Femi, some of it's been ugly. There's been a lot of doxing, leaking personal information online of some GOP senators on the Judiciary Committee. Christine Indeed. Blasey Ford, what are you seeing?
Well, doxing is a long word for docs or documents, and that's basically giving out people's personal information. It can be a kind of cyberbullying as well. So during the Kavanaugh hearing on Thursday, some Republican senators at the hearing had their Wikipedia pages altered, so personal information was added. They are public political figures. Some of their information was gained from their public website, but some of it was private. Wikipedia has adjusted that. The senators involved, including Mike Lee, who's a Republican from Utah, Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, and also Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina. Perhaps in a more sinister sense, it was Professor Ford's information that was going around on Twitter still when she was talking about the kind of harassment that she was having to deal with at the hearing. Her personal information was also on Twitter. People were complaining. Twitter eventually removed some of those tweets, but they said it wasn't against their company policy for people to tweet information that was available publicly. Yeah. But a lot of that information is now offline. But people were saying, this is her home address, this is her office address, let's go and have a protest outside of her home or outside of her office.
Yeah. Well, look, and when you talk about the Wikipedia information being hacked, I just want to mention that Kavanaugh was asked about entry into his calendars of the Devil's Triangle. He said it was a drinking game.
Robin, you brought this up. I was avoiding this for taste and decency.
Well, but no, on my part. But just want to point out that, you know, the Urban Dictionary, of course, says that it's something else, that it's a sexual act between two men and a woman. But
yes. People
hacked the Devil's Triangle definition to say a popular drinking game enjoyed by friends of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. So there are lots of that going on. But talk about the partisan divide. You know, people who are supporting Christine Blasey Ford use the hashtag #BelieveWomen, but others were using a back bread hashtag. Tell us about that.
Yeah, let me start with back bread. This is the nation, actually the world, who's on social media weighing in. They're watching the hearings and they're also weighing in on their opinions as well, obviously. Back bread, let me give you an idea from what back breaders are saying. Amu Allen says, these allegations should be thrown out now, leaving a mind who can remember what happened 35 years ago. It is easy for slight back then, and that can grow out of all of reality. So not a believer there at all in Professor Ford. And also says, back Brett, because crocodile tears and a well-rehearsed story does not solve the problem. There was never a report and there is not a shred of evidence. Against that, legions and legions of women and men saying hashtag I believe. There are very distinct, very visual, incredibly iconic pictures of people with "I believe" on their hands and really getting behind Professor Ford. And it's almost as if we're back in the 60s having this feminist debate fiercely, but right now in 2018 across all the social media platforms.
Yeah. Look, we've only got about a minute, but there was a tweet that launched a headline. Elon Musk tweeted about possibly taking his company Tesla private. There was a rapper at his home at the time who said he was on drugs. Then he appeared on a radio talk show. He appeared to be using marijuana with the host. Well, his tweet has now launched a federal lawsuit. Just briefly, how are people reacting to that?
He's in so much trouble right now. And Elon Musk, and we've talked about him in our social segments over the months and the years. And he's been a hero of social. He's got an incredible number of followers and people listen to every word he tweets, which is probably why he landed himself in trouble. And now he's being vilified and people are making fun of him because of a tweet that was less than 140 characters.
Yeah. And if you have 22 million followers and you're running a $50 billion company, as Vox says, you probably don't want to tweet
what out. Tweet. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Mean stuff.
Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English with a look at news filtered through social media. Thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin. Take care.
You too.
A note about a few stories in the news that may have been lost in all the news coming out of Washington. Facebook says it doesn't know whether hackers had specific targets in exploiting security vulnerabilities to access some 50 million user accounts. Facebook executive Guy Rosen says the attacks seem broad and that Facebook doesn't know who's behind them or where they're based. It has taken steps to fix the problem and it has alerted authorities. Pope Francis has defrocked a Chilean priest who is a central character in the global sex abuse scandal rocking his papacy. In a statement, the Vatican said Francis had laicized or secularized the 88-year-old priest who was originally sanctioned to a lifetime of penance and prayer for having sexually abused minors. Francis invoked his supreme authority to stiffen the sentence handed down by a Vatican court in 2011. Meanwhile, President Trump met today with the president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera. The two leaders discussed trade, security, and the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. As Venezuela's economy has neared collapse, tens of thousands of migrants have left for Chile. And one other story we're following, Trump has signed an $854 billion spending bill to keep the federal government open through December 7th. He averts a government shutdown in the weeks leading up to the November midterm elections. A White House official said Trump signed that legislation to fund the military and several civilian agencies today without journalists present. Okay, time now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Russ Boris is DJ and music director for WFUV in New York. Hi, Russ.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what have you brought for us today?
Lots of great stuff. I'm just really kind of taken by this new EP that Iggy Pop has put together with the guys in Underworld. It's called Tea Time Dub Encounters. And what I love about Iggy is just kind of being fearless as he's been over the years, especially more recently working with Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age, putting out a record that was sung entirely in French. Iggy's doing whatever he wants to do these days.
And this is the song I'll See Big.
I wanted to have some friends. Not a lot of people wanted to be my friend. A couple of nerds, maybe. And nerds have trouble being friends because they're too stopped up. I mean, they can play games with you, but after that, you get a kind of blank stare.
Okay, so I feel like I'm watching The Big Lebowski. This is Iggy Pop is 71 years old, and as you can hear here, talking, not singing.
Yeah, there's something about this that feels so richly rewarding to me. I don't know if it's this sort of somber tone that he has while he's kind of recounting his early days and having this story of friendship that just feels very sweet to me.
And what should we know about Underworld?
Underworld is a legendary electronic band that has been making records for several decades. And the collaboration with Iggy and Underworld started, I think, as the story goes, they were both overseeing the T2 Trainspotting soundtrack. And Rick Smith from Underworld got together with Iggy and just more or less said, hey, we should really do something. And he doesn't want to be the guy to say no to this. So, yeah, he ventured right in.
All right. Up next, you have brought us the artist Jealous of the Birds. This is called Plastic Skeletons. Jealous of the Birds, by the way, is the stage name for Naomi Hamilton, who is from Belfast in Northern Ireland.
I caught her set at a South by Southwest, I believe it was last year, it wasn't even this year, and was so completely taken by how impressive her live show was and how each one of the songs was better than the next. But it was all much more minimalist and much more subdued. And so when I first heard this song, it threw me for a loop, just having some awareness of who she was and what I had seen previously. This is the new song that's on this new EP called The Moths of What I Want Will Eat Me in My Sleep.
Wow.
Now, I don't usually get really worked up about album titles, but I had to talk to her about this one, and she did a recent session for us. And it stems from poetry that she had written, is that that's pretty much where she had begun as an artist, and that transitioned into songwriting.
I wonder how common that is, because a lot of songwriting does sound like poetry.
I would think that it's probably more so than we think, for that exact reason, yes.
Okay, let's go to the next song. This is Love is Magic. It's by John Grant.
They say you were always enough. It's too ridiculous to call it love. And you're staring at a dresser door, which is devoid of clean underwear. You're trying to work out on your calculator if you can swim that trip to anywhere but here. Love is magic, whether you like it or not.
No surprise that John Grant's Twitter bio labels him as a synth lover. Billboard called him a surrealist indie star.
You know, there's a number of different adjectives you can use to describe the music of John Grant, for sure. I've always gravitated to his dark sense of humor. You heard the line in there very quickly about staring at a dresser drawer which is devoid of clean underwear. These are lines that are fairly common in his music, but this song in particular, there's a lot more positivity in it as well. As the song evolves and you listen to John sing with, you know, as rich a voice as I've heard recently, he just has a knack for conveying a certain emotion. But in this particular case, it's a little surprising because he's singing into the positivity of love and actually, you know, not walking away from it, but walking towards it.
Okay, the next one that you have brought us is called Waiting on the Warmth. It's by the Toronto-based Mormor.
Lights fade, it's a youth face that's never left your side. You know, you're just a kind to let it all aside. You came to play a card today. I'm on my way home. You count my ways, I can't delay.
Very smooth, very energetic. Who is Mormor?
He's an artist out of Toronto. His name is Seth Nyquist. And you know, at this point, there's just a little bit of music out there from him. And I just heard this song and thought, I wish that pop music sounded like this entirely in 2018. I just wish this was pop radio. It's just, There's something very familiar about his voice. There's something very familiar about the feel of this, but it's completely uplifting, and it just struck me the first time I had heard it. There's a handful of songs on this new EP called Heaven's Only Wishful, but certainly showing a great deal of promise.
Why do you think a song like this won't be all over the top 40 stations in this country?
I think it doesn't necessarily fit into a perfect little package. And even though there's something that's very accessible about it, you know, if it's not what the mainstream or what the machine dubs as, you know, their 10, 15, 20 song playlist dictates, then it doesn't necessarily work its way in, I guess.
Okay, we have time for one more, and this is St. Lucia with the song Walking Away.
I told you once, and I told you twice. Keep it up, and they might come calling for you. Take it up, that's good advice. You only want now that they got everybody. Sometimes it feels like they just want you away. Sometimes it feels like they just want you away.
What did you like about this one?
Well, you know, per my earlier comment about more being, you know, sort of perfect 2018 pop music, you know, St. Lucia, you could probably suggest, is perfect 1988 pop music. I've always gravitated towards St. Lucia, just the joyous nature of the music and what feels just bouncy and always fun. In this particular song, there's might be a little bit more groove than what they've recorded in the past. I hear elements of Chic in the guitar riff. It makes me think of, you know, 70s, which is interesting considering how much of the 80s connection is in what St. Lucia does. But again, just very bouncy and fun.
And St. Lucia, by the way, not from St. Lucia, but from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Yes, in Brooklyn-based these days.
Brooklyn-based. Okay, Russ Boris, Bronx-based at the moment, DJ for WFUV. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we've got all of our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now, or you can find us on Apple Music or hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Elon Musk may have sent the most expensive tweet ever when he told his 22 million followers last month that he was about to take Tesla private. The electric car company's stock price tanked this morning after the Securities and Exchange Commission announced it had sued Musk over the tweet. Here's the SEC's Stephanie Avakian.
We allege that Musk's statements were false and misleading because they lacked any basis in fact. At the time he made these statements, Musk had not secured funding for the proposed transaction. To the contrary, we allege that he had not even discussed key deal terms, including price, with any potential source of funding.
Joining us now is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I guess the message is be careful what you tweet. And a lot of people looked at what Musk did and thought he's going to get in trouble for this. But what's the case from the SEC here?
Well, right. It all goes back to that original tweet where he said he's thinking of taking the company private at $420 a share. In other words, thinking about getting a group of investors together to buy the company, remove it from the public stock exchange and operate it as a privately held company for a price of $420 a share, which was well above where the stock was trading. And the key words in that tweet were he said funding secured, which made it sound like he had lined up the investors to do that, when in fact he hadn't really done that at all. He had some interest from some outside investors, but had really not gone through the process of getting that funding in place to the point where you could announce it like this to the public. And the SEC is basically just pointing at that carelessness. They also point how he had promised to burn short sellers, in other words, people that were betting against the stock. Mm-hmm. And they even went so far as to point out that the 420 number was likely a reference to marijuana, and they allege that was an attempt to impress his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So pretty much the whole tweet is the predominance of their case.
Well, and when he tweeted that, the stock of Tesla went way up immediately. So anybody that you know held he could have said to his friend, I'm about to tweet this thing about we're going private, and the friend could have made a lot of money on that. So that's what the SEC says, that's not okay.
Right. So, you know, there's basically two groups of shareholders you have to worry about here. Those that bought the stock after that tweet, believing that he really was going to come mm-hmm. through with a $420 offer. And then the shareholders who have been impacted since. Now, the stock's well below where it was trading before that tweet. There's something close to $20 billion worth of market cap removed from the company. So sort of two different sets of shareholders that have both been damaged by this.
And the SEC wants to fine Musk but also ban him from serving as an officer or director of a public company in the future. Is that likely?
Well, that's the question on Wall Street right now. They certainly have the power to do that. But again, if you recall what the core mission of the SEC is, it's to protect shareholders, to protect investors, not just shareholders, bond investors as well. And if they were to remove him from a leadership role in the company, a lot of people worry that the company would struggle going forward. So those shareholders would actually be hurt worse by this. So it's quite a dilemma the SEC has here, where it's trying to punish the guy, but it also doesn't want to really impact shareholders too much, presumably. So it's quite an unusual case.
And it's also a company, Tesla, that is seen as one of the most innovative at the moment, at least in the auto industry. Mike Regan at Bloomberg News, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
What a day. This morning, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake announced he would vote yes to move Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court to the full Senate from the Judiciary Committee. He was then confronted by angry, tearful women. And by this afternoon, when the committee vote was supposed to take place, he emerged to say he'd vote for the nominee if there was at least a week delay in the Senate vote to allow for an FBI investigation. The committee voted to move forward, but it's not clear if that investigation will really happen. Meanwhile, yesterday's testimony from Kavanaugh and his accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, still reverberates. Two people, two stories, two ways of telling them. Professor Ford was deferential.
It is not my responsibility to determine whether Mr. Kavanaugh deserves to sit on the Supreme Court. My responsibility is to tell you the truth.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh was combative. Here's an exchange with Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar, who just referenced her father's problem with alcohol and asked Kavanaugh about his use.
So you're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened?
That's you're asking about, yeah, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? That's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
I have no drinking problem, Judge.
Yeah, nor do I.
Okay, thank you.
Well, after the break, Judge Kavanaugh apologized.
Just going to say, I started my last colloquy by saying to Senator Klobuchar how much I respect her and respected what she did at the last hearing, and she asked me a question at the end that I responded by asking her a question, and I did that. This is tough process. I'm sorry about that.
I appreciate that. I would like to add, when you have a parent that's alcoholic, you're pretty careful about drinking.
But what if Klobuchar wasn't that gracious, or Ford for that matter? It was a he said, she said, but what about how they said it? Lily Gorin is professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Professor Gorin, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on today.
So what did you hear when it came to what people are saying? Were very different approaches.
Yeah. And I think that that's part of what is being dissected and considered. A lot of people talked to me about that yesterday, that Professor Blasey Ford was composed and also presented a bit of vulnerability or fragility, but was also cooperating and, you know, sort of steady. And that, you know, it was quite a contrast when Judge Kavanaugh came to speak that he started out in a very kind of incandescent rage, if you will, and then was extremely combative. And then you also had Senator Lindsey Graham, who was also sort of demonstrating a kind of rage in his questioning.
Let's hear a little bit of Lindsey Graham.
To my Republican colleagues, if you vote no, you're legitimizing the most despicable thing I have seen in my time in politics.
So, Professor Gorin, it's hard to imagine if Christine Blasey Ford had unleashed that kind of rage. But the New York Times media critic writes, this is a demonstration of how men and women are socialized to speak in public, one rewarded for being furious, the other rewarded for not being shrill, which means, of course, a woman can't be furious because it's interpreted as being shrill. Do you
or hysterical.
Or hysterical. Do you agree, you know, that this is sort of, to do it any other way, especially for the woman, would just not have been well received?
Yeah, and you can also look at the difference between the way that Christine Blasey Ford presented herself before the Judiciary Committee and when a Black woman, an African-American woman in Anita Hill, who had to present herself actually not as being vulnerable when she spoke in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little more of Christine Blasey Ford. Here's one interaction between her and the Judiciary Chair, Chuck Grassley.
Ms. Mitchell for Senator Graham, and then it's my understanding that that's where you'd like to take a break.
Does that work for you? Does that work for you as well?
We're here to accommodate you, not us.
I'm used to being collegial. So.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm used to being collegial. You know, we hear it there. She could be referring to the academic world as opposed to the world of politics, but people interpreted that as being a woman.
Yeah. And again, you know, even in the academic world, we academics know from the way that our students perceive us and what they say on student evaluations, that there's a big difference in terms of, you know, sort of the presentation of information by men and women in the classroom, by African-American men or white men in the classroom, by women of color in the classroom versus white women in the classroom.
Well, Zoe Chance, who's a marketing professor at the Yale School of Management, said that in terms of, you know, winning over public opinion, both Ford and Kavanaugh did the right thing yesterday, because there is research showing that, you know, everything we've been saying, men can seem to be more influential and competent through shows of anger, women less so. But in this case, it's a man, and understandably angry because he's been accused, although she's also been accused of lying. But on the other hand, others are pointing out this is exactly the kind of anger that is a trigger for women who have been abused.
Yeah. If you also think about it, his anger was presented by him explaining that he is a victim of these attacks on his character, on his name. I mean, he said repeatedly about his name being besmirched. And yet you have Christine Blasey Ford, who's also saying, I was a victim of this particular incident. So you have two forms of victim presentation.
Well, and we heard that in his voice when he talked about how his daughter talked about at her nightly prayers that she should pray for this woman who had accused her father. There were tears there. Some said that that was inappropriate, but others have pointed out, and Glenn Sachs, interesting, he writes about men's issues a lot. And he was really upset that Kavanaugh was being criticized for welling up and having tears. Glenn Sachs says this is part of the constraints on men.
And I think that's part of the sort of ongoing discussion about these issues around toxic masculinity, the strength of women in positions of power. And, you know, we have this discussion during the 2016 election with regard to Hillary Clinton, as she's articulated a kind of very narrow bandwidth that she's allowed to operate in as a public female who is running for office.
Yeah.
Christine Blasey Ford wasn't running for office.
Yeah.
She was presenting herself in terms of what she said was a civic duty.
Well, in some ways, the humanity, the ordinariness in her voice struck a lot of people. But can talk for a second about her voice. There was discussion on some of the networks covering this that it sounded girlish. Others pointed out, and I noticed this in some of the social media, that women who are talking about assault when they're, you know, 15 might go back to that age.
Well, and again, you know, I've never met her or seen her speak, and so I don't have anything also to compare it to.
Yeah, right. You don't know if that's just her voice. But whatever happened in the hearing room yesterday, today, other voices were unleashed. And I just want to get your thoughts on this. This is right after Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake said that he would vote in favor of Judge Kavanaugh. He was thought to be a swing vote. Women approached him. He was on the elevator. So the camera shot is from behind these women. One said that she was a survivor of sexual assault and that he was telling women in America that they should keep quiet about that. Let's listen.
Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter, that what happened to me doesn't matter, and that you're going to let people who do these things into power.
Just, Professor Gorin, as we go, look at me when I'm talking to you. He wasn't. He was looking kind of shamefaced down at the ground. Do you think this moment in time is going to shift some of these hardened dynamics? The woman is conciliatory, or she's seen as hysterical, and the man can be angry.
I don't know if the, you know, ramifications of this kind of dynamic that we saw yesterday will have an impact on, you know, our sort of cultural understanding of how women and men can present their emotions. And again, there's a big distinction between white women and women of color and white men and men of color in terms of what they can and cannot publicly demonstrate in terms of emotions.
Lily Gorin, professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University. Thank you.
Thank you for having me today.
Fall is here, and with it, a new season of TV. But the fall lineup looks like it may be another drop in the steady ratings decline that network television has seen for years. Broadcast television is facing tough competition from cable and streaming. On-demand video companies are investing more and more in developing their own shows. Netflix, for example, is set to nearly double its catalog of original content. So how are the networks set to compete? Well, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans says they're playing it safe rather than choosing to innovate. Eric, it doesn't sound like that's the good choice. Hi.
Well, you know, as a critic, I would prefer that they actually innovate. But they seem to have decided they're going to play to their strengths. And some of these shows we're going to talk about will show how that's a bad idea.
Okay, let's start with Magnum P.I. from CBS. A hit in the 80s, Tom Selleck's, you know, goofy, freewheeling protagonist solving crimes in Hawaii, duking it out with Majordomo Higgins. He's now over on Blue Bloods with the mustache.
Yeah, Selleck is.
Selleck is the mustache that has its own, like, Twitter feed and everything. But what about this new Magnum P.I.?
Well, you know, there's superficial updates to it, right? The new Magnum P.I. is played by Jay Hernandez, who is Latino. And the Majordomo Higgins is played by a British woman now. And, you know, it's an awkward kind of thing. You know, the reason the original show worked is because Tom Selleck had so much charm. Jay Hernandez is not in that league, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of feel like the show is one of those empty reboots that we've seen CBS do a lot of. They did a MacGyver reboot. They did a SWAT reboot. It feels very much like a decision that was made in a corporate boardroom. You know, hey, we own this thing and, you know, we can retool it for 2018 without any sense of a creative reason why we should return to this character and update him.
Okay, well, there you go. Fox is the cool kids. This is about a group of retirees. They throw ragers and make trouble in a retirement home. You know, a lot of people know someone in a retirement home, and co-creator Charlie Day, he says he based the pilot on his own experience working in a similar facility. Sometimes storylines like that, backstories like that, you know, really can pump a show up, but, you know, does it work?
Yeah, is it funny is the question. No, it's not funny, at least not yet. So this show feels like it was written by people who are not that age. It feels like it was written by somebody who worked as a worker in one of these places, because these characters are sort of empty stereotypes. You have the blowhard leader who's played by David Alan Greer. You have this sort of hippy-dippy aging boomer who's played by Martin Mull. And then another character played by Les Jordan, who's a gay man who you get the sense he's been closeted through a lot of his life, but now he's out. And they get disrupted when a woman tries to join their group by sitting at their table at dinner, played by Vicki Lawrence. And I think we actually have a clip of that. Let's check it out.
Mm-hmm. Look, lady, I don't know who you are, but you can't sit there.
Why not? Who are you guys? The cool kids?
Damn straight we are.
Really? Him?
Vicki Lawrence from The Carol Burnett Show. Oh, come on. Does she deserve better?
Well, they all deserve better. These are all great performers, and they're playing empty stereotypes of older people. Mm-hmm. I think this show suffers from the fact that the people who are writing it and producing it are mostly 20 or 30 years younger than the characters that they're portraying.
Quickly, The Neighborhood from CBS, about a white family that moves into a black neighborhood in Los Angeles. Pretty clear from the beginning they're not welcome. Here's one of the neighbors talking to the family.
There aren't a lot of other people like you around here.
I'm sorry, are you saying it's going to be a problem that we live here?
No, all the science says it's good for people to live in diverse communities.
We couldn't agree more.
Too bad, my dad hates science.
Jim, if that's how he feels, we shouldn't go.
No, you gotta come or you'll seem racist. Is that the original hard way on this door?
Okay, so it's a reverse storyline. Okay.
So, CBS has had a historic problem with diversity. It's a big thing for them that they have a show that has so many black characters in it. But to have this show be about a well-meaning white family moving into a black neighborhood and it's the black people who are racist to them, it's just, we wanted diversity, but do you have to make the black characters racist?
Right off the bat,
Exactly.
Meanwhile, these are shows that you say just aren't happening for you, but I just want to make sure you've recommended the one that is. The CW's All-American?
Sure. So now this is a show that's actually based on the real-life experience of an NFL player, Spencer Paisinger, who's played for the Giants and the Panthers. And the character is played by this really charismatic young actor, Daniel Ezra, and he's actually a British actor, but you would never know it. He seems very authentic playing a young man from Compton in Los Angeles who winds up playing at Beverly Hills High School, and there's a reason he's there that he doesn't even know about that I won't blow because it's a big reveal from the pilot. But it's an interesting show. It's not amazingly great, but it is promising, and it is trying to have the dialogue about race and class that a show like The Neighborhood actually should be having but doesn't have. This show, at the very least, is trying to talk about differences in race and class in a way that's a little bit more substantive.
Okay, so something to look for there. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this weekend, I'm going to be curling up with some old Masterpiece Theater. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.